bursting sinus cavities, ripping away limbs in a maelstrom of destruction. These calculated and determined effects are charted by the Defense Department war planners in a software program called Bugsplat. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday praised the precision nature of U.S. weaponry and specifically JDAM. And Rumsfeld stated that the use of this weapon expressed, quote, the humanity that goes into the use of our armaments in Iraq.
Precision weapons, Ralph. They over and over throughout the press on television, CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, NBC, you name the station. They keep talking about precision weapons. So precise that already a cruise missile hit a bus in Syria. Cruise missiles have been landing in Turkey. Cruise missiles have been landing in Iran, and cruise missiles have been hitting targets throughout Baghdad. Precision weapons, are they so precise that the U.S. at this moment is attacking Syria, Turkey, and Iran, too?
For the past 12 hours, the latest wave of this nonstop saturation bombing has assailed the capital city of Baghdad and its environs. The arsenal has now exceeded 6,000 missiles and bombs and artillery, all coated, I should emphasize, with depleted uranium. Robert Fisk in Baghdad reports in The Independent in London, a cauldron of fire, hundreds of feet of sheets of flame, and sounds that are shattering ears, the entire city shuddering under the impact. Cruise missiles come in wave after wave. It is the heaviest bombing that Baghdad has suffered in over 20 years. All across the city, massive explosions are shaking the ground. To my right, a long colonnaded building is coughing fire as missiles crash into the concrete. Shock and awe? Shock is hardly the word for it. My friends, the people of Baghdad are cursing under their breath. The city is under a wave of attack such as has never been seen before. The ominous B-52s in wave after wave after wave with their missiles and with their bombs.
Shadows of Agent Orange, third generation of Vietnam victims. This is an article by Gail Bensinger, Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle staff writer. Shadows of Agent Orange is not an article that appeared 10, 15, 20 years ago. Shadows of Agent Orange, referring to the third generation of Vietnam victims, appeared today, Monday, March 24th. And she reports directly from Vietnam about five-year-old Fung, who looks out at the world through huge, sad eyes, as she wiggles her shoulder deeper into her mother's embrace. Her attempt to hide is not just shyness. Fung has already learned that strangers are less interested in her sweet face, her gold earrings, her cheerful cotton dress, than in her left arm, a useless stub that ends just below the armpit. Her other arm is normal, remarks Gail Bensinger. If you overlook the hand with only three fingers, so are her legs and feet, though she has only nine toes. Nearly three decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange has reached the third generation. Fully half of Vietnam's 82 million people were not yet born when the last U.S. helicopter lifted off in the frantic days of April 1975. Yet, here we have the third generation, and the incidence of afflictions from Agent Orange matches the wartime bombing patterns, and in many cases have skipped a generation, so that Fung, the third generation of Vietnamese children, is afflicted by the effect of Agent Orange. And this is what we are seeing in Iraq, what the Iraqi medical doctors have been reporting since the Gulf War. The generations of mutilated children who were born without brains, with thalidomide-like deformities such as prong is evidencing from Agent Orange. These children are deformed from depleted uranium. Depleted uranium, a basis of U.S. weaponry, now being used against the Iraqi people.
Maya, on June 18, 1966, Bertrand Russell penned an appeal to the American conscience. I appeal to you, citizens of America, as a person concerned with liberty and social justice. Many of you will feel that your country has served these ideals. And indeed, the United States possesses a revolutionary tradition which, in its origins, was true to the struggle for human liberty and for social equality. It is this tradition which has been produced by the few who rule the United States. Many of you may not be fully aware of the extent to which your country is controlled by industrialists who depend for their power upon great economic holdings in all parts of the world. The United States controls over 60% of the world's natural resources, but contains 5% of the world's population. The minerals and produce of vast areas of this planet are possessed by a handful of men. I ask you to consider the words of your leaders who reveal the exploitation they practice. The New York Times on February 12, 1950 stated, "Indochina is a prize worth a large gamble. In the north are exportable tin, tungsten, manganese, coal, lumber and rice, rubber, tea, pepper and hides. Even before World War II, Indochina yielded us dividends estimated at $500 million a year." And 1 year later, the State Department made the following statement through its spokesperson. "We have only partially exploited Southeast Asia's resources. Nevertheless, Southeast Asia supplies 90% of the crude rubber, 60% of the tin, and 80% of the copra and coconut oil. It has for us sizable quantities of sugar, tea, coffee, tobacco, sisal, fruits, spices, natural resins and gums, petroleum, iron ore, and bauxite." And Bertrand Russell continued, "In 1953, while the French, financed by the United States, were still fighting in Indochina, President Eisenhower stated, quote, 'Now let us assume we lose Indochina. If Indochina goes, the tin and tungsten on which we so much depend will cease coming. We are after the cheapest way to prevent the occurrence of something terrible, the loss of our ability to get what we want from the riches of the Indochinese territory and from Southeast Asia,' unquote." This makes clear, said Bertrand Russell, that the war in Vietnam is a war like that waged by the Germans in Eastern Europe under Nazi control. It is a war designed to protect the continued control over the wealth of a region by American capital. When we consider the fantastic sums spent on armament and awarded in contracts to industries on whose boards of directors sit the generals who demand the weapons, we see that the military and large industry are an interlocking alliance for their own profit that controls the government of the United States. The truth is that popular resistance is just like that of the American revolutionary resistance to British rule. The British crown who controlled the economic and political life of the American colonies in the 18th century. Yes, Vietnamese resistance and the resistance of the oppressed is like that of the French Maquis, the Yugoslav partisans, and the guerrillas of Norway and Denmark to Nazi occupation. That is why a small, oppressed peasant people can hold down a vast army of the most powerful industrial nation on earth.
Ralph, last night on MSNBC, a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Trainer made a remarkable statement. He was asked, "Why is there any resistance from the Iraqi army?" It was with great surprise that he was asked this question, and his response was, "The Iraqi army may or may not be defending Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi army is rising to the occasion to defend Iraq and to prevent a U.S. occupation."
And Russell stated at that time, 1966, in his appeal to the American conscience, "I appeal to you, citizens of the United States, consider what is being done to the people of Vietnam. Can you, in your hearts, justify the extended use of poison chemicals and gas, the saturation bombing of an entire country with jelly gasoline and phosphorus? Although the American press lies to you about this, the documentary evidence concerning the nature of these gases and chemicals is overwhelming. They are poisonous, they are fatal, and they are ubiquitous in their use. And Bertrand Russell did not know at that time about the tactical nuclear weapon of depleted uranium, which, as you were describing, Maya, has caused an epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities across Iraq. And that was as a consequence of the first Gulf War, when 380 tons of depleted uranium permeated the aquifer, the atmosphere, and the soil of suffering Iraq. And now 15 times that quantity of depleted uranium have already been visited upon Iraq in the short few days since this saturation bombing has been launched by Bush and his cronies in Washington. U.S. will use depleted uranium, says the BBC. Colonel James Naughton of the U.S. Army Material Command has stated, "We will continue to use it. They want it to go away because when we use it, we kick the crap out of them," Colonel Naughton stated at a Pentagon briefing. Depleted uranium, a byproduct of uranium enrichment for nuclear weapons, has valuable military properties. It is very dense. It is 1.7 times heavier than lead, and unlike other materials, is self-sharpening when it penetrates armor. We will use it, and we will use it continuously, Colonel Naughton declared in his briefing.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're coming to you today during the scheduled time for Mike Levine's Expert Witness Program. Mike Levine is out of town and will be back next week. You can listen to Taking Aim tomorrow also at our regular scheduled time of 5 p.m. in the New York Tri-State region on WBAI 99.5 FM. WBAI, Ralph, was mentioned in the Wall Street Journal because of the excellent coverage, the definitive coverage of WBAI and other Pacifica stations throughout this genocidal campaign as assault against the Iraqi people and also consequently against the people of the United States. Now, we commend all of the engineers and staff throughout the United States who've been working on this nonstop coverage of anti-war protests. I want to take a moment to look at what has been going on in the press to try to undermine the extent of our protests. In the San Francisco Chronicle this Sunday, March 23rd, there was an article called "War on Iraq, the Price of Protest. Dealing with protests is costly for San Francisco." And the city, according to the mayor, is spending almost $1 million a day. And he makes a lot of statements over and over and over again, saying that because of our anti-war protests, San Francisco probably will force even more layoffs and service cuts than predicted. Quote, "It probably means an increased number of health care workers will lose their jobs. That probably means a health care clinic will be impacted," says Mayor Willie Brown. "That probably means restricted areas at swimming pools. Anything that relies on general funding may be adversely affected." $1 million almost a day? What is this $1 million for? Mayor Willie Brown is turning the downtown San Francisco into an armed camp. An armed camp. An armed camp of motorcycle police, of SWAT teams, an armed camp of 15-hour-a-day double-time paid police who are probably going to be buying their third home, not even their second home because they already have second homes from the amount of overtime that is paid for, to them for administering the Hollywood movies that are shot here and also for our peaceful demonstrations. Let me tell you, The demonstrations in San Francisco, as the demonstrations throughout this country, have been rallies, orderly, and self-controlled. We know how to take to the streets in an orderly fashion. We know how to protest. The money that has been taken away from our social services is money that has been spent needlessly to protect, perhaps, the blocking of Bechtel, a company that has been making billions of dollars throughout the world through the privatization of water, through the construction of military bases, and potentially through the construction of an Iraq that would be occupied and where the funding will go to U.S. contractors. Mayor Willie Brown and mayors throughout the United States, the money that you spend on police is money not, is money you might think is protecting business, but is an attack, a direct attack against the free expression of the anti-war protesters throughout the United States. And we protest your diversion of funds. Stop the police. Support the anti-war protesters. Close down City Hall and let the workers into the street to join our protests.
What we're dealing with here is a sustained policy of mass destruction that has its little beginning. I hate to say it, but it is the elementary fact. It is has its little beginning of a permanent campaign on the part of these rulers that we are now witnessing once again in Baghdad. Ira Chernus, in a significant article called Baghdad, the Next Hiroshima, asked the question, have you heard of Harlan Ullman? Everyone in the White House and the Pentagon has. And they may well follow the plan that he has proposed. And Ullman, by the way, is the author of Shock and Awe. He is planning to do to Baghdad what we did to Hiroshima. He is called a defense intellectual. He is the Navy's head of extended planning and at the National War College. One of his students, Secretary of State Colin Powell, stated, Ullman has raised my vision. He has taught us how to proceed. And indeed, Ullman's conception of this war, which he called a shock and awe, inciting Sun Tzu, was for the permanent and rapid dominance on the part of the United States. He stated, we shall create electromagnetic waves that attack people's neurological systems. We shall control the will and perception of adversaries. We shall affect their behavior on a permanent basis. You have the simultaneous effect like the nuclear weapon at Hiroshima. Not in days, not in weeks, but in minutes. We are preparing super tools and weapons, the information equivalent of the atomic bomb. He wrote in the Economic Times, as the nuclear weapon dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki had its impact, these tools will be directed to similar outcomes, first in Baghdad and then in other places across this planet. This is Ullman. This is the author of Shock and War. War criminals, these are self-confessed mass murderers and war criminals proclaiming their intent well in advance and celebrated in the media by a virtually gleeful pimps for the Imperium on all the major networks, on all the major stations, who have as their objective the rationalization, the justification, and the celebration of the mass murder of their masters. That is the nature of information under capital. That is the character of the corporate media that has its sole purpose of preparing our people for yet greater slaughter and for greater suffering at home as well.
You can go to our internet site, www.wbaifree, that's wbaifree.org/taking aim. We have an archive of Taking Aim programs from the last several months. And on that archive are many programs that deal specifically with shock and awe and the ongoing plans for the invasion of Iraq, the control of the resources, particularly going into depth as we did a week ago and beyond that, with the plans of the Project for the New American Century, plans that state specifically how the United States should go about enacting the domination of Iraq and actually going from Baghdad to Beijing. There's a continuity. There is a blueprint, and that is spelled out. And we have these programs that we have done over Taking AIM in the past weeks and months that elaborate and take you to the very sources on the Internet where you, too, can read about these blueprints.
Maya, it was called on ABC Television News, The Plan. The Plan. Quote, years before Bush entered the White House and years before the September 11th attacks set the direction of his presidency and the conditions under which he would operate, a group of neoconservatives hatched a plan to take on Iraq and to remove Saddam Hussein's government from power. The Project for the New American Century, founded in 1997, with three central officials who were sitting out the Democratic presidency of Clinton, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Paul Wolfowitz. The group was never secret about its aims. In an open letter to Clinton, they openly advocated unilateral U.S. action against Iraq, and for that to be the starting point for the dismantling of a series of countries throughout the Middle East. Of the 18 people who signed the letter of demand, 10 are now key figures in the Bush administration, ABC reported. And indeed, on the 21st of March, in the Wall Street Journal, Bush dreams of changing not just a regime, but a region. Robert S. Greenberger and Carby Leggett detail the implementation of the plans of the Project for a New American Century, plans which we have documented so often on Taking AIM, have as their genesis the intent since the 1960s to seize Arab oil.
Well, it looks, Ralph, like the established media is catching up with Taking AIM, and also you were writing about this, the plans for the occupation of Iraq and fragmenting the Middle East, in Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, which was written at the time of the first Gulf War, and actually lays out much of what is happening today. You are listening to Taking AIM with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're coming to you on the special program today, March 24th, over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. Now, WBAI is a listener-sponsored station. It is for you, it is of you, and we are so glad to be a part of the WBAI community. We are coming to you today via telephone, and we will also be on tomorrow at our regular time, 5 p.m. on Tuesday. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 and leave a voicemail and we'll call you back. That's 212-209-2953, or you can write to us by email at takingaim@pacbell.net. We have an internet site at www.wbai3.org/takingaim. And you can find an archive of our programs if you would like a CD or audio cassette to share with your friends and family. Please contact us at the numbers I mentioned before. Our program today, Dresden to Baghdad, Sustaining Capitalist Rule.
You know, it's interesting, Maya, that as you mentioned in Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, we documented how each administration of Republican and Democratic parties alike since 1964 have made preparations for the direct seizure of Arab oil, for the direct military occupation of these countries, and were putting into place operational plans which were seeking the opportunity and the pretext for their implementation. It's instructive that the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, James Askins, described at the time an article that was published in Harper's Magazine under the title Seizing Arab Oil. He stated that anyone who proposed this course is either a madman or a criminal. It's interesting because the background and deep background preparation for that article was provided by then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. And indeed, Carter, President Carter, after the overthrow of the Shah of Iran in 1979, declared, we shall prepare force to gain control of the Gulf region, and we will use any means necessary to accomplish that end. Jimmy Carter in 1979, from 64 throughout the late 60s and the 70s, every spokesperson for Capitol, through one preparatory plan or another in the National Security Council, in the Defense Intelligence Agency, in the State Department, in the Council on Foreign Relations, have only disputed the tactics and the means through which this objective was to be secured.
Very similar to the work of Zbigniew Brzezinski in his grand chessboard outlining the plans for seizing the Caspian region to control the oil, and also the strategic basis of the Caspian region for U.S. Army military bases to control Asia and also have control over the Middle East and Europe. Bay to Baghdad. I keep referring to San Francisco because it turns out that San Francisco plays a key role in today's war, one that I had not realized before. In yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle business section, and this is available on the Internet at sfgate.com, there is a key feature. The entire business section is taken up with it. War on Iraq, Bay to Baghdad. Scores of area businesses feed military machines, need for gear, and another article, Lockheed Martin, stands out as the Bay Area's key player. And it says here in an article by Todd Wallach, quote, sprawled out over at least 500 acres in Sunnyvale, Palo Alto, and other locations, Lockheed for decades was Santa Clara County's largest employer, churning out generation after generation of nuclear missiles and military satellites. At its peak in the late 1980s, the company employed 25,000 workers, eclipsing Silicon Valley icons like Hewlett-Packard and Intel. So those of you who think of Silicon Valley, the heartland of the computer industry in the United States, and that's why it's called Silicon Valley, I have a feeling that you, as I, didn't know that Silicon Valley had its origins and still remains today one of the key players in the military-industrial complex. Billions and billions of dollars, more than 900 companies from Healdsburg in north of San Francisco to the major city now of San Jose, south of San Francisco, relying upon the military-industrial complex for their major profits. Major profits in the same page of this business section, David Lazarus, who does reporting on economics, quotes the figures. The Tomahawk cruise missiles dropped on Baghdad so far cost $1 million per cruise missiles. The hundreds and hundreds of cruise missiles, the anticipated launching of 3,000 cruise missile attacks against the people of Baghdad and throughout Iraq, $1 million each. Each bomber run over the Iraqi capital costs up to $15,000 an hour. An hour! $15,000 an hour. Each aircraft carrier group deployed in and around the Persian Gulf carries a price tag of $3 million a day. $3 million a day. And each meal ready to eat, the MREs that they so proudly display on TV and consumed by U.S. forces, is cost $677, a daily cost of more than $3 million to feed the 250,000 soldiers. And as Secretary of War, no longer Defense, Secretary of War, as it used to be called, misnamed Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld says, we don't know the cost of this war. And that is why they have not submitted to Congress any appropriation. Had they submitted to Congress an appropriation before this war, who knows what would have been the case. But look what Congress has done now. Let us look. Democrats, Republicans alike, They have all been going like lemmings, with very few exceptions, to pass a budget that allows for $100 billion as the first stage cost of this genocidal attack against Iraq. And it is no coincidence that in the very same budget appropriations that this Congress of Democrats and Republicans alike have passed has as a line item cut $100 billion for Medicaid, the health coverage for the most impoverished here in the United States. Subtract $100 billion from Medicaid and allow for $100 billion for the genocidal appropriations to keep the war machine contractors in San Francisco, as in city after city throughout the United States, reaping massive profits.
The Houston Chronicle, Maya, 1992, published an article about an investigation that was being carried out by FinCEN of the Treasury Department, and that investigation concerned the theft and laundering of huge amounts of money through a series of Saudi royal operatives who were prominent in the BCCI and in Citibank. And these included Khalid bin Mahfouz, the brother-in-law of one Osama bin Laden, and they included the father of Osama bin Laden and the brother of Osama bin Laden, who were the pass-through instruments for vast sums of money, and to whom? To Harkin Energy of George W. Bush, and indeed to father and son's sequel to the Harkin Energy scam, the Carlyle Corporation, a $14 billion corporation. This is the relationship between these gangsters, this capitalist structure, and indeed the comprador elements, these very feudal rulers who embraced the Osama bin Laden family, who were part of the economic profit-making machine of Bush father and son, an intimate, a constant, a structured, an institutional relationship through the BCCI, through the Nugent-Hand Bank in Australia, through the funding of Harkin Energy, through the creation of the Carlyle Group, and here, in Business Week, Bush Sr.'s profitable crossing. This on February 22nd, the former president made a tidy $4.5 million from his shares in the now bankrupt Global Crossing. And indeed, this article, and I should emphasize that this is February 22nd, 2002, the Business Week expose of the venal relationship between Bush father and indeed Bush son and the bankrupt Global Crossing, which they looted 100,000 Global Crossing shares in Elder Bush and his wife Barbara. Millions of dollars looted by this gang of criminals. And here on March 23rd, 2003, a year later, we have an article in the Washington Post called Pearl's Plunder Blunder. And the article says, it's Richard Pearl's world. We are just fighting in it. The prince of darkness, who whips up revelatory souffles and preemption doctrines with equal ease and takes victory laps at the American Enterprise Institute on Friday mornings, who trumpets the critical battle for Baghdad, who is the prophet of shock and awe, the hawks who are sending a message to the world not to mess with them, and indeed who have prepared the intimidating bombing campaigns. Yes, Mr. Pearl, the advisor to Donald Rumsfeld, who has been crowing about preemption, and who has coined the phrase, the two-word phrase, the message for the peoples of the Middle East, you're next. And what is the plunder blunder of Richard Pearl?
Ralph, let's make clear that Bush Sr., Bush Jr., the Bush administration, this is one aspect. Sustaining capitalist rule is Democrats and Republicans alike. And the other night on Charlie Rose, he had Richard Holbrooke, who was part of the Clinton administration. And Richard Holbrooke was gloating as if he knew better. He had given advice to the Bush administration, and he was referring to the U.S. Sponsored bombing of ex-Yugoslavia and the subsequent occupation. And he was talking about bypassing the United Nations, which has been an instrument of imperialist rule throughout. But what Holbrooke was saying was that the Bush administration had done the right thing in its strategy, just as the Clinton administration, in bypassing the United Nations and attacking Iraq, as the Clinton administration had attacked Yugoslavia. And then, when it comes to the occupation, the United Nations and other countries would step right in because they saw the profitability of it.
I'm glad you brought that up, Maya, because in mentioning Harkin Energy and the Carlyle Group and the investigation by FinCEN and the articles in the Houston Chronicle of 1992, one of the kingpins in this entire operation was Jackson Stevens, a principal in the Defense Intelligence Agency, whose base of operations for his vast economic banking and corporate conglomerate was none other than Venice, Florida, from which the putative training center of these air flight training groups was the vehicle through which Mohammed Atta and his colleagues were supposedly trained, although they were actually being trained in U.S. military installations. Jackson Stevens was the main funder of the Democratic Party. His actual headquarters was none other than Mena, Arkansas. He was a principal financier of the Clintons. He is a primary backer of both the Republicans and the Democratic parties. And it is the Jackson Stevens connection to both the Saudi feudal elite and the illicit banking of BCCI Nugenhand that illuminates the way in which the Republican and Democratic parties operate. Richard Holbrooke, Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton, the 90s, the sanctions in Iraq, 1.5 million civilians killed as a consequence of these sanctions. The use of depleted uranium throughout fractured Yugoslavia in a deliberate campaign to dismantle that nation and to target all of its ethnic groups in turn through the clandestine special operations forces that were working both with Milosevic against the Croats and with Tudjman against the Serbs to fragment and break up Iraq, excuse me, Yugoslavia, much on the model that they have in mind now for the Middle East. I was mentioning before, Maya, Pearl's Plunder Blunder, the article in the Washington Post, and that article continues, and I think is apposite, particularly in the light of the revelations about the virtual thievery of Bush Sr. from Global Crossing, because this article on March 23rd, 2003, states, the confidant of Rummy and Wolfie, who serves as the chairman of the Defense Policy Board, that influential Pentagon panel, is none other than Mr. Pearl. And that's why Global Crossing agreed to pay Mr. Pearl the fat fee of $725,000, the fee structure especially smelly because this windfall is contingent on government approvement of sales over which Mr. Pearl has authority. Utilizing his position on the Defense Policy Board, he is still bound by government ethics that forbid officials to reap financial benefit by selling their position in government office. He and his lawyer claim that Global Crossing did not violate the rules, but we know that, in fact, he has profited from his position and he has exploited it to the hilt. We are dealing here with thugs, with crooks, with gangsters, with a ruling class that is venal, that presides over the economic structure of our society, and that just changes its hat when it moves into government and utilizes the state as its own funding base. And the military of this country, this vast arsenal of destructive power, as the instrument for imposing and continuing imperial rule. Halliburton wins contract on Iraq oil firefighting, states Reuters on March 6th. A detail of how Halliburton, Kellogg Brown and Root are already salivating, as the report describes, their opportunity for vast profits in the reconstruction, as they call it, of Iraq on profitable terms.
Ralph, well, I spoke before of the $100 billion that goes to the war contractors, the replacement of missiles, the MREs, the clothing, the night vision equipment, and, of course, the cruise missiles, the satellite systems, and so forth, $100 billion. And part of that $100 billion, a small part of it, is for the occupation of Iraq, not only the $200,000 a day that it costs to maintain a U.S. Occupying soldier, but also the plans of the USAID, plans that actually go step-by-step, match the plans that were established by the Baker, the James Baker Institute at Rice University and the Council on Foreign Relations, the vision for a post-conflict Iraq. They have been writing out this vision for a very long time. And what it says in the USAID document, the vision for post-conflict Iraq, is, quote, USAID will help build a new framework for economic and governance institutions. On past shows, we spoke of the actual plans for running the government. The Justice Department has prepared a 600-page document, which will be the new laws for Iraq. Now, recently, USAID sent out bids only to American companies for $900 million for the first step for rebuilding bids. This is to Fluor Daniels, to Bechtel, to Halliburton, as you mentioned, and to other companies like Louis Berger. $900 million. It's only the tip of what's going to be the gigantic iceberg for U.S. profiteering throughout Iraq. And this is not for the oil. This is for the actual day-to-day operations of Iraq.
Maya, the nation. On April 7th, its forthcoming issue, Pearl Interrupted, by Eric Alterman. Stop the presses, he says. The famed Prince of Darkness, Richard Pearl, the political animal unique to Washington, has successfully melded personal, ideological, and commercial entrepreneurship into a polished package that looks kosher so long as no one examines its particulars. And in this important article, Eric Alterman spells out the venality, the criminality, the profiteering that is linked to mass murder through the person of Richard Pearl. But it is, of course, not Pearl any more than it is the Jackson Stevens or the Bushes. This is the class. This is the structure that requires a perpetual war for the imperium, and these are the personae who are the directors of this ruling class and the beneficiaries thereof. Forbes magazine. On March 6th, an important article by Eric Hassadal, The Cost of Conflict, Iraq's Post-War Oil Opportunities, spells it out. Brothers and sisters, here are their projected profits from their operations that are intended to take place after the destroyed nation of Iraq is occupied by American capital. Halliburton, $18 billion. Schlumberger, $29 billion. Baker Hughes, $28 billion. BJ Services, $31 billion. Weatherford International, $26 billion. Smith International, $28 billion. Neighbors Industries, $34 billion. Jacobs Engineering, $17 billion. The list goes on. The beats goes on. This is the rule of capital. Let us have no illusions about it, brothers and sisters. Let us not have any lesser evils or evil lessers in our horizons. We are dealing with a class enemy that for over 150 years has visited war and devastation upon the peoples of the world and keeps our own population in sway in pursuit of these objectives of profit, exploitation and profit, and mass murder to cement the deal.
Now, one way, Ralph, that they... one thing that they have to impose on Iraq in order to extract these profits is not just an occupation, but it is a remaking of the Iraqi economy. Iraq has a nationalized oil industry, and one thing they are going to do is to privatize, to break up and privatize this oil industry, and maintaining those Iraqi bureaucrats who align themselves with the notion that it is okay to allow the complete exploitation by foreign oil companies. The very thing that the Iraqi people had rebelled against, and at the time of Abdul Karim Qasim, had thrown out the foreign concessions throughout Iraq.
The result of a revolution, let us make clear, the revolution of 1958, the revolution that removed the stooge of Baghdad, Nuri as-Said, the revolution that resulted in the confining of the oil companies to 0.1% of Iraq, the revolution that brought the Central Intelligence Agency to utilize their asset Saddam Hussein to murder Abdul Karim Qasim and to set up the torture chambers through which hundreds of thousands of students, of teachers, of trade unionists, of intellectuals, of village leaders, of peasants, passed and disappeared, much as they did throughout Latin America, much as they have in occupied Africa, neocolonial occupied Africa.
Now, throughout the USAID document, it talks about setting up the private financial institutions, whether it's in housing, which is now funded by the government, or if it's in food distribution. They talk about market-based food distribution to be established, or as in education, to break up the national integrity of the economic base of Iraq, which to be controlled by the population is not the desires of the United States. As we all know, it is not the liberation of Iraq. It is for the domination by profiteering companies.
That is indeed what illuminates imperial policy under whatever guise. Kofi Annan answered the criticism that he should have left the inspectors in Iraq instead of pulling them out to accommodate the saturation bombing of Iraq. He met that criticism by stating that the United Nations was preparing to carry out humanitarian operations in post-occupied Iraq. So here we have the explicit acknowledgement that the UN role is that of the junior partner going through the motions, as they do in Somalia, of a humanitarian process in a devastated country with a starving population being exploited to the hilt by U.S. capital in its occupation mode.
In the few minutes remaining, I want to remind people that we will be on tomorrow again at 5 p.m. for our regularly scheduled Taking AIM program. And we will be going into much more detail. For instance, I have the documents connecting the Bank Lavoro, the BCCI fame, to Iraq at the behest of the United States at the time of the Iran-Iraq war.
And these are central and defining pieces of information. Brothers and sisters, we have to understand the overall picture. Generation after generation is confronted by the same set of challenges. And each time we are faced with the depredations of capital, whether at home or abroad, we are also presented with the evil lesser or the lesser evil. And the longer we postpone a challenge to the one big property party with two names, the longer it takes. Those who think, those who say, that whether the instrument of the United Nations or that of the Democratic Party are an alternative to the Bushmen should be reminded of the comment of C. Wright Mills, the great radical sociologist, in his book The Power Elite, when he described the attempts to choose between the evil lesser as crackpot realism. The Washington Post on the 23rd of March had the following article by David S. Broder: Cutbacks to Our Children Under the Shadow of War. The House and the Senate fought a series of skirmishes over the federal budget, and the answer is that youngsters yet to be born will see their choices devastated and their prospects blighted by the decision of the politicians of both parties to press ahead with tax cuts which make any social spending entirely impossible. They will double the national debt in the next decade. Hundreds of billions of dollars will be wasted. funds no longer available for Social Security, Medicare, or the myriad responsibilities of this government here or abroad. And the squeeze is not prospective. The dangerous economies being forced upon the United States entail cutbacks that have long-term damaging consequences for the majority of the people of this country. This in the mainstream media, this in the Washington Post, this illumination of the relationship between war and capitalist rule. We must challenge this system. We must prepare the political fight back. We must build the political instrument out of this anti-war movement that challenges these people for power, brothers and sisters. Nothing short of that, no longer the lesser evil. It is a struggle for the future of our society. It is a struggle to prevent mass murder on an unprecedented scale in country after country on this suffering planet.
Into the streets are anti-war rallies, bigger, bigger, bigger. Anti-war efforts in the streets are the thing to do.
At the point of production, through the organized working class in our labor unions, through the struggles against the war, for the struggles against the destruction of all the gains that working people have made over the past 100 years, for a struggle for power in this society, for a revolutionary transformation of this society, because nothing short of that will put an end to this devastation, to this mass murder, and to this race to the bottom for working people.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We will be with you again tomorrow, Tuesday, at 5 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. Please let your friends, your family, and colleagues throughout the world know that they, too, can listen to Taking Aim. You can reach us by voicemail at 212-209-2953. Write to us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We have an archivable program at www.wbai.org/takingaim. And also contact us if you prefer a cassette or a CD of any one of our programs or specials. We will be with you tomorrow, and good luck with your anti-war protest.